Denizlerde cidde bir eki yaman su. Kızımla aldı hele meyvesti mi? Uzak kızla haber kötü. Sağınudur indi bu heller.
David, should I start over, Richard? Was I not on air? Okay, I'm going to start over. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO, and this is the second part of today's Friday Radio Zine. And coming up in this segment, I'm going to be speaking with David A. Smith, who is co-editor of Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. David will be speaking about the issues of inequality in America tonight, and it is a forum. Join the Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. Tonight, David A. Smith will be speaking along with a panel, including Michael Leachman of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, Reverend Marilyn Sewell, Senior Minister of the First Unitarian Church, Tom Chamberlain, President of the Oregon AFL-CIO. This is tonight at the First Unitarian Church at Southwest 12th and Main in downtown Portland. Doors open at 6:30, and it starts at 7. There is an admission charge. It's a sliding scale. No one turned away for lack of funds on that. So, David, I want to welcome you to KBOO. Thanks for coming in today.
Well, thanks for having me.
And let me say also about David's background that he is a senior fellow in business, society, and democracy at Demos. He previously served as director of public policy at the AFL-CIO and as an aide to Senator Edward M. Kennedy. Now, this book, Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences, is a compilation. You are the co-editor, and there are a number of people in here, including Barbara Ehrenreich, David K. Johnston, others that people, Jim Wallace, people who may be recognized by our audience, and then others who may not be. Can you tell me how this came about, to do a book like this?
Well, at first, you're right to observe that this is a collection. A lot of very talented women and men contributed to it. The book was born out of an observation that seemed increasingly powerful to me, that no matter what you cared about, if you cared about access to decent public education, if you cared about the distribution of quality health care, if you cared about the strength and robustness and vitality of our democracy, you ought to worry about the growing economic divide. You ought to worry about the fact that, and it's not just the Bill Gateses and Warren Buffetts of the world pulling away from the rest of us. That's always been true, and it's pretty much still true. But when you look at the income statistics, Kathleen, what you see is that pretty steadily since the late 1970s, a greater and greater share of both income and wealth have been going to the top 20%. essentially the bottom 80%, so the vast majority of us, staying stuck in place. And that with that increased flow of resources to not insignificant 20% of the population, important pieces of our social fabric and our democratic aspirations begin to come unstuck. Let me give you two examples. The way we finance public education in this country has always been scandalous. We finance it on property values. But as we've seen a chunk of us able to afford expensive homes in expensive communities, those communities tending to provide the highest quality public education because they're able to spend more resources, what we find is that this important ticket, this way in which the building of a middle class and access to the middle class for working class and low-income kids has been organized, becomes increasingly unapproachable. That if you're able to afford to put your kids in good public schools because you can afford a home in an expensive community, your kid has got a leg up that never goes away in terms of their lifetime economic opportunities. So it's an example of the ways in which this phenomenon isn't just unseemly, which it is, but has poisonous consequences, as we say in the title. We continue to finance our democracy with private contributions, and those contributions finance increasingly expensive political campaigns. The average winner in a congressional campaign in 2004 spent over $1 million. That money doesn't come from most of us. Only 0.1% of us, a terrific work by Chuck Lewis in the book documents it, only 0.1% of us can afford to and do make the maximum contribution to any candidate in any election cycle. It has an enormously distorting effect on who our political leaders see, who they talk to, how they understand the world, and most importantly, how they behave. It's inconceivable to me that with a public finance system or a system that was more democratically organized, that we would have passed the enormously distorting tax cuts that we've passed in the last 5 years. So it's not just that the democracy depends in an unseemly way on the willingness of the rich to pay for it, but that has consequences, as direct, measurable consequences that affect the vast majority in disadvantageous ways.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, this book covers so many areas. The various authors look at income differences, wealth differences, education differences, retirement differences, college attendance differences, health status as opposed to health care, health status of people, how the inequality is manifested throughout these various areas. And that, I think, is actually the strength of this book, is that it, not only is it written in a style that's easy to understand, but it's just the accumulation of these various areas and how inequality is manifested in every area, that you realize this is just permeating our society in its consequences, as you say. So you mentioned the political aspect, the fact that the very wealthy are now pretty much totally funding our political system is one area. And I wanted to get into some of these areas just briefly and just give people other examples of just what the current situation is. So if you could talk for a second about a little bit more about, say, college attendance.
Well, college attendance is an important ticket, an important part of the idea that mobility remains available in the society. And we've had two enormous waves where we've used public policy and public resources in order to make opportunities to go on to post-secondary education available. The first, of course, was the GI Bill, when literally millions, mostly men, but some women as well, but millions of folks returning from the Second World War became the first member of their household to attend college. And that laid the basis for the economic growing together that created the American middle class in the 50s and 60s. And we paid, you know, we did it on purpose. It was the right thing to do, and we paid for it with public dollars. In the early 70s, we began to try to recreate it, not quite as dramatically, but with a system of grants to low-income kids going into or looking to go for higher education. And those grants weren't as they weren't as extraordinary as the GI Bill, but 30 years ago, the average Pell Grant covered 75% of the average tuition for either a public or a private college. Today, the average Pell Grant covers less than 40%. But we've stripped away resources that in the past have been used to give some reality to the notion of equal opportunity. Our elite educational institutions are more economically segregated today than they were in 1980. Not only are we not making progress, but we're reversing progress that we had made in the previous decades.
Let's take another area and look at it for just a second with some input from you. Health status. What are some of the characteristics that show us what inequality is doing in the area of how healthy people are?
Well, let me read you something. Recently published in a journal that probably doesn't get quoted very often, either by me or on KBOO, but this is from an article in the most recent issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And Michael Marmot, a British health economist, writes, he's talking about the United States, "The United States spends more on health care than any other country, around 15% of a large gross domestic product. Yet the United States ranks 29th in the world in life expectancy. Something is not right. And that something is the gross inequities in health seen in U.S. society, and these inequities are in turn related to features of society that fail to meet basic human needs and varying degrees of dependency on social or economic position." What Marmot observes, and David Williams and Jim Lardner observe in the book, is that economic status doesn't actually affect your access finally to the healthcare system, except for large numbers of unemployed young people. But economic status has, regardless of whether or not you're insured or not, has an effect on the likelihood of your coming down with dangerous and potentially deadly non-communicable disease. And these are diseases related to stress. They're related to fatigue, conditions which are made worse for those folks who are struggling every day to make a living, to take care of a family. They are more susceptible than folks with higher economic status to those kinds of preventable but clearly socially related diseases.
I wanted to look also at the issue of retirement. You are the co-author of a chapter in this book on retirement and what's happening as far as inequality goes with respect to retirement. Can you give us a sense of the current crisis in that area?
Sure. Let me back up a bit. You know, one of the proudest achievements of the post-war decades was a dramatic reduction in the percentage of senior households living in poverty. In the mid-50s, almost 30% of households headed by someone over 65 were living below the poverty line. We've driven that number down to less than 10%. And we've done it primarily with two universal tools that cover all of us. One is Social Security, and the decision to index Social Security to the cost of living that was made during the 60s, and the other is Medicare, which currently pays slightly more than 50% of all of the health care costs for virtually every American over 65. Those are examples of social insurance programs that rested on two big ideas. One big idea was that we're all in this together. And insurance mechanisms where we all contribute, we share the risk, nobody is exposed to downside on their own, nobody gets to grab the gold ring on their own, work better than systems which essentially say, it's up to you. You're on your own. Nobody's going to take care of you, pay your health care bills, make sure you have a decent retirement, so you got to do it yourself. So we invented all of these ideologically driven mechanisms, 401Ks, replacing company-paid pensions. So 401Ks and IRAs and Roths and KEOs and all the stuff that the financial institutions try to peddle you rest on a very different big idea. And that's an idea that you are on your own. And what's happened is as that idea has triumphed, both in the political and intellectual debates, is we've begun to dismantle the pillars of a retirement system, which by and large work pretty well. Defined benefit pensions, which mean you get a check every month for as long as you live and you can't outlive it, are now held by a tiny and rapidly declining share of American workers, and they're replaced with something which has no guaranteed income stream associated with it. It's like a 401k, and that you can outlive. So if you're fortunate enough, and your spouse is fortunate enough to live a long and active life, the chances of your outliving your retirement are deteriorating. Certainly talked on this show about the many problems with the new Medicare drug benefit. Once again, it breaks with the tradition that we're all in this together, and that we ought to have a collective mechanism for ensuring that healthcare resources are available. And it instead is built on a system that's designed to say, oh, no, we don't want to do something that's universal. What we want to do is let the market rule, let choice rule, and make sure that the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical manufacturers can make enormous profits. And Marmot mentions, you know, we spend 15% of national income of national gross product on health care. We get very little for it. And part of the reason that we get so little for it is we rely on this administratively heavy, decentralized, terribly balkanized delivery system instead of a national health insurance system that covered everybody and, like Social Security or Medicare, can be run at a tiny fraction of the cost that you end up paying when you privatize this system and you're paying for, you're not only paying for corporate profits, but you're paying for marketing and advertising and this blitz of stuff that doesn't do one bit to lower anybody's drug bill or make sure they get the right drugs. It simply sorts out whether or not your drug's going to be provided by Humana or United Healthcare. That's a crazy way to spend this sort of money.
I'm speaking with David A. Smith. He is the co-editor of Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. He is speaking tonight as part of a panel discussion at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. That's at 7 tonight. Doors open at 6:30, and that church is at Southwest 12th and Main. David, this trend that you've talked about that pretty much applies to all these areas seems to have started in the 70s. Is that what you would say? Is there a way to generalize the trend that we're seeing?
You get slightly different numbers when you use different dates. But in the late 70s, we began to see a reversal of a trend where, as President Kennedy said, rising tides lift all boats. And for most of the first three post-war decades, that was true. Income went up for everybody, and it went up slightly more for those at the bottom end of the income distribution. But beginning in the late 70s, the rising tide stopped first, and then after that, it began to lift boats at different rates. Kathleen and I are looking at a little graph that unfortunately those of you can't see, but it does tell us that that starting in the early 80s, the quintile, the 20% with the highest incomes, began to get more, and everybody else began to get less. So that 20% of the population pulling away from 80% of the population, and that's continued unabated since the early 80s. And it's reinforcing and making more dramatic all of the other things we've talked about. And, you know, and that's simply looking at income. That same 20% of Americans own 84% of the wealth. So 20% own 84%, and the wealth meaning, you know, stocks, bonds, homes, automobiles, and 80% of the population owns only 16% of the total wealth. And those numbers are growing apart even more dramatically than the income numbers are.
You mentioned to me earlier off air that there looks to be a trend now that these inequalities are being built into the system in a permanent way. Can you describe what you meant by that?
Well, let me try. We talked a minute ago about access to high quality public education and access to high quality post-secondary education. To the extent that those things now are, and I think most observers would agree, those things now are tickets to greater economic success, and we make them harder to access. We have built in something that isn't going to be overcome by your wit or your energy or even your good luck if you're not able to garner the educational credentials that a small minority of the population are. Things like retirement. The New York Times did a piece about 3 weeks ago in the News of Week in Review looking at census data about the distribution of older baby boomers, what older baby boomers were going to be able to leave to their kids. And for a long time, economists have believed that older baby boomers were going to leave a lot of money to their kids. And it's true. More money than any generation in American history has ever passed on to the next generation. But what's extraordinary about that is that while the total number is going up, the median number, meaning the size of the bequest in the middle, is going down. And what that means is that after the baby boomers' wills are probated, the society is going to be more unequal than it was before, as this chunk of the retirement pie gets as distorted as the retirement pie that means only the wealthy can afford to fully fund their 401k and everybody else is looking at a declining balance. That will have permanent effects. And I think the other way in which it's getting built in permanently is the political effect, which is not entirely but substantially a consequence of the way we finance our elections and the role of a small wealthy minority in financing elections, is producing public policies that will be very hard to undo. So in that sense, these trends are getting built in. This isn't some temporary phenomenon that's related to technology or trade or even education, as so many people say. Somehow, you know, we'll outgrow the education deficit. Well, that's not true in a society where access to the best that we have to offer in the education system is controlled by how many dollars your folks have.
So what can we do to, is there anything we can do? Is it now permanently in our structure of our society? Can we do anything to abate this?
Well, I'm an optimist. I don't think it's easy, but of course we can. And it is important to remember in answering that question that when we've set out to reduce inequality, we've succeeded by and large, right? And the world hasn't changed. There's no reason that we can't have a universal health care system for everybody like we had a universal health care system for senior citizens. There's no reason that we have to have a minimum wage, which isn't enough for a hard-working family to live on. We can raise the minimum wage, and we've done it steadily, except we stopped. And the minimum wage is now at its lowest purchasing power level since it was enacted in the 1930s. We know that membership in a trade union produces not only better wages and benefits and better treatment in the workplace, and it reduces inequality both in racial terms and in gender terms, but we've made it more difficult, not easier for working people to join a union. There's important labor law reform that we could pass if we put our minds to it. We passed tax cuts that made the distribution of income even more unequal. We didn't have to do that, and we can undo it. And in this case, I mean, I do think that people in the streets are way ahead of political leaders in believing that something can be done. Within the last month, three more states, Oregon being one of the original states, but three more states passed minimum wage laws higher than the outrageous national minimum wage of $5.15. Arkansas, Michigan, and Maine. The enormous outpouring of support all over the country in jurisdictions as different as Santa Cruz, California, and Dade County in Florida, voters have said we're going to pass living wage laws, and we're not going to any longer tolerate folks working in our community who work hard every day and can't afford to feed their kids decently. So we can do that. We can participate politically, and too many of us too often don't. So raise the minimum wage, make it easier to join a union, repeal tax cuts that make income distribution more unequal, and do as voters in Portland, in Connecticut, in Arizona, in Maine have done, pass public financing laws, which no longer say our elections are up for bid and the highest bidder is going to decide which women and men get elected to public office. So yes, there are a lot of things we can do, and we can talk about this. And part of the motivation in putting the book together was, you know, in effect, to create a prop that allowed us and our colleagues more opportunity to talk about this and say, first, it matters, and two, Kathleen, there is something you can do, and get at it.
Okay. Well, yeah, it does make that very clear. If you, as I mentioned earlier, if you do read these chapters one by one, you start to see how this issue affects every area of our lives. So I want to mention again that I have been speaking with David A. Smith. He is the co-editor of Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. And he is also part of the group Demos. I'm sorry, I forgot your position there.
I'm a senior fellow at Demos, and okay. And you can reach us at Demos, demos.org. More information on this topic and others other stuff that I think you'll find interesting.
Great. And again, David will be part of a discussion tonight at the First Unitarian Church, which is at Southwest 12th and Main in downtown Portland. And that starts at 7. Admission is a sliding scale, but no one turned away. And that features other people. It's sponsored by the Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. Thanks again, David, for coming.
Well, Kathleen, thank you for having me, and thank you for what you and your colleagues do every day here.
And we're going to go on to the next segment of the Radio Zine. It is the monthly segment of Sounds of Awareness, hosted by Paul Van Dyke. And we're going to hear that now.